Yeah, they only want to support the socialism that benefits them, and being as how they're libertarians, they're not going to be reading any of them, them books, and they don't want to have anybody reading stories to children, making them want to read, because then if they want to read, well, the odds are that they might want to read something that these people don't want them reading, because knowledge is, after all, dangerous.
Oh, I agree with you, but the fact that this is a historic landmark, and the fact that no one has come to its rescue and come up with the funds, I mean, it's a drop in the bucket, Bob. I mean, if any celebrities wanted to, they could get off their ass.
Yeah, again, how much money do they need?
I don't know how much money they need, but I'm guessing that they could come up with the funds to save it for another year.
Because, I mean, there aren't any librarians out there making, Alex Rodriguez money.
Yeah, that's what I'm saying. I'm saying that they've given notice that they're closing on October 2nd. And I mean, I'm guessing that sometime people have known for some time that this library is in trouble who work in that city. So my point is the fact that you since they couldn't veer any funds to help this library, I mean, I don't know. I see it as ridiculous. I see the contradiction, the hypocrisy, the fact that the City of Brotherly Love's library that's closing. It's so surreal. I just went to the website and that pop-up window just came up just like it said. I have no idea how big this library system is, but I'm guessing it's going to be a big loss to Philadelphia.
Yeah, and I'm getting an email in from our pal Cindy out in the Great Northwest, and she says it's the city library. And sends me a link to a web page that says, what frugal person doesn't like libraries? They're like a video store, only better. Which is why we're horrified to learn that thanks to the economic meltdown and the state of Pennsylvania's inability to pass its budget, the Philadelphia Free Library is closing on October 2nd. They'll be ending all services and programs and closing all of the buildings. They want all of the books back, too. Now, what this means is, I guess this is sort of a... And I don't think it's a hollow threat, but it's just it's a reflection of the reality that's being faced in states all across this country, David. And I, I'm sure, no, oh, dear Jesus, Bob, are you going to make this George Bush's fault too? Well, yes, as a matter of fact, I am. This is what happens when you let predatory sons of bitches, self-made, run a government for 8 years and run it into the ground in part of their ongoing effort to prove that government doesn't work. You lose a flippin' library. A giant library. There's, these things don't happen in a vacuum. Yeah, I agree with you, David. It would be nice if I don't know, who's from Philadelphia? Hall and Oates. They gotta have some residuals out there. Let Hall and Oates jump out there and throw a little chump change at. I don't know. Maybe they spent it all. I don't know. Fabulous.
Campbell and Huff. I mean, people that are organizers in that city.
Let them throw some temporary money at it. But again, this is the appropriate and proper use of the money that the people of any given community, county, municipality, and state and nation put toward their shared existence.
That's what I'm saying. To me, and I know you realize that as well, it's more than just a quote-unquote library. It's a knowledge hub. It's a place for connection, for building the next great minds. And to me, again, I look at this as it's a long-term investment, but it's worth lots of money. Put it up. And that's the problem. I've seen how this works. I mean, it's a historic landmark. Put some protection.
Oh, I'm looking at a picture of it. It's beautiful.
That's what I know, Bob. This is what I'm saying.
Hey, it could be a Walmart.
No.
In downtown Philly, a really cool Walmart with Roman Greco-Roman Revival architecture.
Oh God.
Think of the Action Alley where the reference desk used to be.
With Costco jackets, and they show you to the Rick Warren section. I know that was a low blow, but but that's where we're seriously.
Welcome to the library. I love you.
That's where we're heading. There's the Rick Warren section.
I went to law school here.
Did you?
No. I mean, movie references.
Say, wow.
Well, hey, David, thanks for bringing this to our attention. God, keep an eye on it and let us know. Any update on the watermelon soda?
No, there hasn't been. One last thing, but before I go, maybe you could talk to someone or get send an email out to the Free Library and get their side of the story on the latest developments, because I picked this one off a raw story and I thought, wow, this is really surreal here.
It's past surreal. It is an.
I know.
It's
I know.
Far better than say the breeding of a pure red heifer. This is indication of the end times. You know, there were libraries in ancient Rome.
Yeah, I know. I don't know. This is something to me that if Obama is who he says he is, this is a perfect cause to salvage. I mean, come on, at least keep it open. Give it a chance. I mean, they shouldn't have to. That's BS. Wow. The citizens can't pony up a dollar. That's the crazy thing, Bob. All the citizens of Philadelphia, you say, hey, listen, we need some help. Does everyone have $1 in their pocket? And it's like you at the head on radio. Well, maybe next week. I don't know about that. I gotta buy a bagel. That's the problem. I mean, it's right there. It's you know, there's so many people. Bob, it's just there's nothing you can say about it.
Breathtaking, isn't it?
Yeah.
Yeah. All right, David. Well, take care and have a good evening, and keep us up to date, will you?
All right, later.
All right, thanks. Bye now. David calling from Maine. And let's see, let's keep things rolling. Let's go to Albert. He's been waiting a long, long time. Hey, Albert, welcome to the program.
Hey, Brother Bob, how are we today?
You know, it's quite the interesting little evening. I think we've had lots of food for thought, and I could probably do a six-hour show tonight.
It certainly is. I'll tell you what, yeah, this is a subject what Dwayne was talking about. You know, that's just some brilliant revolutionary reality right there. I mean, that's what it, you know, hello, I mean, you know, you're not going to put fires out dumping napalm on villages, but you certainly will, you know, put fires out when you put a water system in that delivers nice, clean, cool water.
Well, you know, one of the things I didn't mention to Dwayne, Albert, was that there's a certain amount of irony involved here, because it just so happens that I know some folks who were temporarily given leave home from the burning sands of Iraq. And I got schooled a little bit on what they're doing. And you know what they're doing? They're doing Peace Corps work with M16s slung over their shoulders. I know it's ironic and it's loopy and crazy and they're doing their damn dead level best to do this. And yet you want to wait a minute. You're in the blowing things up and killing things business.
Mm-hmm. Exactly.
And you take a guy that's been in the force protection mode and the blowing things up and killing business, and you turn him around and go, okay, you're not going to blow things up and kill things anymore, or people. Now you're going to be a humanitarian.
See, but...
What?
You know, yeah, but see, those are the same gears that run the military-industrial complex. I would like to see more along the lines of what Dwayne was talking about, because that's going to bring up a Peace Corps industrial complex. You know, people join the military for a trade to come home to, you know, and, you know, I was in this, I served my time in the military. I was a cryptological technician operator. What the hell do you do with that in the real world? Nothing. Oh, I can send some top secret information, you know, in 3 minutes. I can do that.
And you can break the code even without the Count Chocula decoder ring.
There you go. But at the same time, it don't pay with very much, you know. What do? I'm a professional cereal eater, and I crack all those little, you know, cuckoo Cocoa Puffs codes. I mean, no, seriously, you know.
You know where the leprechaun, you're always after the Lucky Charms, and you know who it is.
I'm waiting for him.
you got the tiger traps in the front yard. Come out one morning and the little Lucky Charms leprechaun's going to be impaled on a spit. I'm sorry. Shame on me. I'm sorry.
But, no, you know, everybody wants a pot of gold, and, you know, who can blame us? But at the same time, You know, I seriously, you know, what he was discussing, what he's putting forth, you know, that's an answer right there. That's a major answer that, you know, can really do go a long way. I mean, that's, well, what do they say, right? An ounce of prevention's more than a pound of cure or what have you. You know, it's so fundamentally simple that it
yeah, and the journey of 1,000 miles begins with having legs.
There you go. Exactly, you know, and, you know, hell, you know, there are a lot of landmines out there. Well, if you got military EOD experience, you know, you can say, I mean, you bring up the point because you mentioned college students and then they're forced to go work in this, you know, soulless corporate world. You know, my friends were just discussing this just the other day. They've been professional students their whole lives and, you know, now 30s are rolling on them, you know, and so there's not a lot of subjects they can do. You know, she can go get her PhD or the other one's about to be a lawyer. And, they're talking, you know, $300,000 worth of debt between them. Where are they going to pay this off with an English major? Where are you going to pay this off, you know, if you're a lawyer, you know where you're going to have to go. You know, how are you going to pay this crap off? You know,
sooner or later, you know, this kind of dovetails with that that idea that Tom Hartman put out there a week and a half or so ago when he said, screw it, let's lower the retirement age to 55. Because, you know, you want to take people and really utilize their skills, give them 10 years between 55 and 65 or 15 years between 55 and 70 to take all the skills that they've accumulated during a substantial work life and put it to work in the rest of the world, you know, to the benefit of humanity. And with, I don't know, a little bit of a government subsidy for, you know, keeping fed and clothed and... Got a retirement, already got your health care, boom!
Yep.
Changed planet.
Yep.
And by the way, I gotta I don't know if you heard the conversation with David, you know, this horrifying apocalyptic business of closing libraries. You know, that just gives me the chills. I mean the dead sweats. And I got an email rolling in here from David in Tennessee. God, he's always, you know, so far out ahead of the curve that he's on the flat road and we're still turning the wheel. Talking about the Free Library of Philly, he says, needs a champion, doesn't it? Isn't that effing Bill Cosby always squawking about bettering oneself with study? Hell, he probably spent time there before college at Temple. I'm guessing he's got the bank to make it work. And that's, you know, that's the thing, Albert, is identifying. Identifying these needs, you know, yeah. How about a little subsidy, Bill? You know, a little like Bill Murray says in Caddyshack, you know, something for the effort.
Well,
until the Pennsylvania legislature, like every other damned legislature in this country, which has been broken beyond all belief, can find a way to crawl out of the right wing neoconservative. Proto the anarcho-Randian morass into which it has been thrown.
Yes, sir. But you know, here's another. This is the aspect that gives me chills. You know, and I mean, I'm certainly, you know, I'm very fond of my library. We constantly use it. I applauded them when they put solar panels on the roof, but not every place can do those things. I understand that. And I think when push comes to shove, the library is going to get saved. I think people value education.
You have to live in a world that operates that way, don't you?
I have to. Exactly. I mean, yeah, exactly. You know, but at the same time, you know, this is an interesting aspect that I think, you know, it hasn't been really thought about very much in public circles where, you know, the dressings for these wounds that we had from, you know, from this, you know, these bubbles being popped, the dressings need to get changed on these things. And this is where the stimulus money keeps coming in and so on and so forth. You know, and the reason I say this is because I'm directly impacted by what's going on here. You know, we have people in rural Wisconsin because they had that whole buyer house, blah, 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 blah. Well, let me go look real quick. You know, if somebody happens to get a separation and buys a house and gets a tax credit and then tries to turn around and sell the house on top of what they just, you know, got that tax credit on, but then they get remarried, what's that? If someone sits there and buys a house, builds it up, sits there, and, you know, I understand, you know, you put some window dressing and you put maybe new windows in, but then all of a sudden you want another $20,000 on a house where in an area that, you know, loses industrial jobs like, you know, left and right. We have I don't know how many closed factories in this area. You know, there's virtually no jobs, and they're sitting here and they're turning around and they're trying the Californification of the real estate. You know, and this, and why I say this, this is the dressing, because we're going to sit here. We didn't pack it right the first time. We didn't sit there and do the correct things. And we sat there and we continued, just like with this, you know, healthcare bill, you know, we sit there and we're, if we're going to enable the insurance companies, we're just going to end up with a more fetid infection. We're going to get systemic. Okay. And I mean, I think in a sense, we're already systemic. You know, we're walking pneumonia and we just don't know it yet. You know what I mean? But, you know, these kinds of things can cascade down us very rapidly. And this is my big fear, is that, you know, if we don't sit here and really push for serious change with this healthcare issue and all, I mean, the amount of money that I don't even want to get going on there. I know we got limited time, but you know what was discussed tonight is certainly a step in the right direction. You know, that is something that I've always been for. I've always been some sort of public service, but back in the, you know, Red Dawn days of, you know, when cellophane existed, I mean, I didn't think like Peace Corps, or, you're a boy, you grow up in this way and that way, and you got to be so tough and this and that. But you know, so you act like, oh, I'll go join the service, but you know, it would have been nice to have a little bit more perspective back then, or had, you know, a wider range of, you know, how much can you actually accomplish in your life? You can go be a cryptological technician operator and all kinds of codes and catch the Lucky Charms rabbit when he bumps around. But in reality, you know, I would rather know how to build a bridge or to build a house or to build some sort of clean water system, you know, so I could sit here and you know, do something.
Yeah, because anybody who can do what you did obviously has the smarts to learn, you know, lots of different things.
Yeah, but everything's too compartmentalized, so it doesn't work like that. It works in terms of how much money you have invested in you and so on and so forth, and then it becomes very specialized. I think that's why we see the problems that we do in every aspect of...
Right, because we have pilots who are trained to be pilots who blow up bombs or blow up bridges, mm-hmm. and we have pilots who are trained to be pilots who deliver humanitarian aid on giant, you know, the C-5s and C-130s.
Yeah.
And it is. It's compartmentalized. And you seldom need to send a coded message to anybody saying, go forth and do, and you know, be ashamed to die before you have won some victory for humanity. You know, that doesn't need to be encoded, does it, Albert?
No, sir. No, sir. That needs to be broadcasted far and wide. And
multi-band.
Absolutely. And I'll tell you what, I do keep my ear on to National Petroleum Radio, because it's what I get when I don't have the horn near my ear, but... You know, you bet next time they mention anything like that, I'm certainly bringing, you know, everything that Dwayne, you know, as much as I can. They only give you a couple seconds to speak, but, you know, I'll have to get the website up and memory and put it on my little post-it note on my Vista machine and just, you know, have it there for future reference, because, you know, these are important things. You know, I'm sick of, you know, all the killing and murder and bloodshed and mayhem and destruction that we cause. Yeah, all right, I understand a lot of these guys are sitting there over there, you know, building these little houses, doing this and doing that. But, you know, at the same time, well, the guys that were there before him, you know, before them, were blowing the, you know, leveling towns and, you know, Fallujah. That's all I got to say. You know, and that's the other thing. You know, this is the other thing. We need some people that have this kind of experience to be in charge of where the allocation of funds goes. You know, because I'll never forget this. This is back in right after we invaded Iraq. You know, Rumsfeld and then what's his name, and you know, they were giving all the Bremen, you know, that other scumbag. They're giving all the contracts to all the, you know, Cheney buddies and all those other guys. Remember? And there was a bridge that the Iraqis could have fixed. They would have employed Iraqis right after the war, right after the insurgency started up. They could have started employing Iraqis to rebuild this bridge. It would have cost, you know, $1.1 million. Instead, they give it to Bechtel or what have you, and they had $40 million. And we're gonna send our guys over there to do that. That makes sense. That just doesn't, you know, that doesn't make any sense. Let these people, I understand.
It's the 21st century version of the 19th century practice of sending one's laundry from San Francisco to Hawaii. Howard, I do have to roll. We got a couple of blinkies I want to hit, but you know what? I have a suspicion that this will be a conversation whose tenets and basis sort of ripple like a stone thrown in a pond, and we've only touched on it this evening. God, like I said, I could do a 6-hour show tonight. I could, except I got to listen to Malloy.
Absolutely. And, Bob, enjoy your tingles. You deserve every tingle you get, especially, you know, I tingle for you when I hear your name as well. You know, everybody likes everybody like that, and you deserve your tingles, so take those tingles and let them energize you. And Ferg, you take your tingles too, but you just watch where you put them. All right.
Yeah. Albert, later, brother.
All right, be good.
Bye, all right, Albert. Bye now. The sage of Southwest Wisconsin, that's brother Albert. And, yeah, watch where you put the tingles. Yeah. Okay. Sorry. Words of wisdom. Yeah, great words of wisdom to young Ferg in here, who gets so much learning out of this program. And some substantial yuck yucks when folks like Spike call. You know, Spike had him on the ground last night. It wasn't even close. Oh, okay. Hey, welcome to the program.
Hey, Bob. It's Kevin.
Hey, Kevin. What's up?
From Brooklyn, of course. You know, the conversation before the last one, I just want to, you know the word I'm trying to get at, is that the dumber our youth are, is the better obedient soldiers and workers they make.
And all God's children said amen.
Yes. Okay. You know, part of the reason, and I think I told you my story before, where part of the reason why I decided to leave IT briefly and try to become a teacher. It's basically to have these kids start thinking.
Yeah, and you know, part of the reason this could easily be a six-hour show is because of an article that I received today from our dear friend and colleague, Dr. Bill O'Brien, who spends a lot of time thinking about this kind of stuff. I heartily commend to you and to everyone else this article. It comes from Bill is a Bostonian, and no matter how many years he spends in the wilds of Appalachia, he's gonna continue to be a Bostonian at heart. And you know, that's the beautiful side of regionalism in this country, Kevin. Like, you know, you're gonna be a Brooklyn kid. If you're living on Maui,
no.
And you know, there was our conversation with Dwayne earlier, and you know, I don't know how long he's not been in Cleveland, but you can still hear the Cleveland in his voice, and it's a magnificent thing. You know, two or three PBRs in or whatever, and the Alabama redneck starts coming out in me, so you know how it goes. But no, I heartily commend this article from Boston.com by Diane Ravitch to everyone, and the title of it is Critical Thinking, You Need Knowledge. And this is hand in hand and heart and soul with what you just said, Kevin, and with what David was bringing up. And what she writes just the very beginning: the latest fad to sweep K-12 education is called 21st century skills. States, including Massachusetts, are adding them to their learning standards with the expectation that students will master skills such as cooperative learning and critical thinking and therefore be better able to compete for jobs in the global economy. Inevitably, putting a priority on skills pushes other subjects, including history, literature, and the arts, to the margins. But skill-centered, knowledge-free education has never worked. You know, do that again. Skill-centered, knowledge-free education has never worked. In other words, you get some sort of theoretical appreciation for how to put a screw in a board with a screwdriver, but they don't show you a screwdriver, a board, or a screw.
Yeah. Well, the thing is, you know what bothers me the most about this country as is right now is how much we are replicating, you know, Germany throughout its history from, let's say, roughly the late 1700s to the, no, not even late, I'll say 1600s to the middle of the 20th century. Because don't forget, Germany was the policeman of the world at one time. The Hessian mercenaries were all over the planet. And I have a feeling that's what's going to happen to us. And to much of our youth.
Well, you may be using the wrong verb tense. Just to be, you know, it's not a gonna, it's done happened.
It's happening, yeah. And that's what bothers me, you know, how much, you know, because we are privatizing our army. You know, people, black America, and again, I'm going to have to go back to black America because that's my first.
It's your frame of reference. Mark. It's perfectly legitimate.
Okay. You know, there's in the early part of the 20th century, there's a debate between, I believe, George Washington Carver and W.E.B. Du Bois. And between what roles should black America either be useful or be thinking. And George Washington Carver, who founded the Tuskegee Institute, which is basically a technical school, where, you know, you learn the things that was accepted for quote-unquote Negroes to do, which was nursing, you know, maybe a few of the more educated ones would have became preachers, carpenters, things like that, farmers, and all that stuff. But, you know, I think, and he's often vilified in the black community, W.E.B. Du Bois,
yeah,
of being very arrogant and very egotistical. He's vilified, and it's because even black America, just as bad as white America, black America cannot take too many thinking black people, too. They cannot.
Wow, you're gonna get some stuff for that, yeah. Kevin.
Trust me, I will. Okay, and a prime example is what happened last week with Van Johnson.
Well, I thought we isolated that as a function of uppity.
That too, but too many thinking, really deep thought thinking black men. In one thing, it makes us too powerful, and we won't know our place.
Yeah, it's bad. Oh no, not gonna do it. Just
yeah, exactly.
I didn't start to say exactly. Anything. I'm not gonna, and can't make me.
And I can list another historical reference: the Haitian Revolution, where you had so many on an island of competent black leadership. And all the time, and what kills us all the time, why it's our history, like the Irish or the Celtic people, which I like to say, has been a series of one step forward, two steps back, is because we always look for this Moses-like Messiah figure. And when he is no longer on the stage, and we'll go a couple of steps forward, but when he's gone, we'll go a couple of steps backwards. And that's been happening for generations here.
But isn't that the sort of countermarch of human progress as well?
But it seems to apply more for Celtic and African people.
I mean, look at the ancient Greeks. Look at the progress of Roman emperors.
Yeah.
You start out with a guy, Octavian, who later becomes Caesar Augustus. And he's a brilliant administrator, and he lives to be, you know, he lives to be 72, 73 years old or something.
Yeah.
And really starts to set things to rights in Rome with the constant promise of, well, I'm going to restore the Republic one of these days. And he, you know, he ruled all... I think Eugene Finnerman will certainly straighten me up, but he ruled longer than any other emperor, I think. And from there, it's a steady progression of really, really batshit crazy emperors, outright evil emperors, and the occasional good one who winds up spending all of his time trying to fix the things that were broken by the last 12.
Oh, yeah.
The presidency is the same way. We're not over and perhaps won't be over even after... I guess you would say that my generation is the youngest generation that experienced John Kennedy as a president, because even though I wasn't aware of it and I was, 10 months old when he was killed, I was at least on the planet.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know that when my generation goes off to its long home, America will be over that. And we're still, And I've talked about it so many times, Kevin. How many generations will we spend getting over 8 years of George W. Bush? You know, we're not done getting over Reagan. Christ almighty, we're not done getting over Richard Nixon.
We're not done getting over Hoover.
That generation is completely dead, and we're repeating the mistakes of the Hooverian era, for Christ's sakes. Yes.
We're not done getting over Johnson, the first Johnson. You know, the one between Lincoln.
Yeah, Andrew. Yeah. Hey, Kevin, dadgummit, we've run up against it. I got a roll. Great thought,
okay,
provoking stuff. I hope we can continue with this tomorrow.
Okay, bro.
All right, take care. Bye.
Bye
now.
Bye.
I knew we'd have great conversation for the remainder of the program. I just need more program. But here it is, 3 minutes before the hour, and it's time to wrap up, and I want to thank everybody for your thoughts. And if there's anybody we didn't get to, I sincerely apologize. All I can say is we'll try it tomorrow night. Wednesday night prayer meeting. And one of the things that I also want to point out is to ask you the ongoing question, where else do you get this? Where else can you get this? I don't think there's a lot of outlets for this kind of conversation in this country. And the one outlet that does provide it does so hanging on for dear life just to be able to do so. It is the 15th of September. We're nowhere near even halfway to what we have to raise to keep out of our own pockets to keep this going. Nowhere near it. Nowhere near $1,000 for the month of September, and certainly way far away from what we would need for the whole month. You know, we try to. It takes a pretty decent chunk of change to keep this going. And when we say that we try to raise $2,000 a month to keep it going, that's not even asking for everything that it takes, because we're constantly in our own pockets. I know the same is true for Guy James. I know the same is true for Ben Birch. If we tallied everything up together, it would probably be closer to something on the order of $7,500 to $8,000 to keep everything going. But the people who are insistent on making this go keep going into their own pockets to their own detriment. And you who contribute, you go into your own pockets to your own detriment. And that's why it grieves me to sit here and say, you know, please. But that's what I'm left doing. We are almost 4 years old. And it has been nothing but blood, sweat, toil, and tears from everyone involved with this to keep it going so that a new listener can find it. I was sitting here working late last night at about something past 2 a.m. and the phone rang from somebody saying, I've been meaning to call. And I just wanted, and I said, you know, hey man, because he was listening on the reruns, the rerun that Mike Malloy so generously allows to run after his program. He was saying, and I said, you know, we're live from 6 to 9 Eastern. We're trying to open these doors. You know, when I get to the point where every phone is lit up the minute that I start the show, and it's lit up till the moment I end the show, you know what I'm going to do? I'll go to 4 hours. If they're still lit up all during the show, I'll go to 5. If I have to go to 6, I'll go to 6. But somewhere along the way, we just have to keep this going. So, thank you for those of you who contribute to the program in oh so many ways. Thank you to the hardest working people, the bravest people I know, the folks at Coal River Mountain Watch, CRMW.net, and Coal River Wind. .org. They are actively involved in being the change that they want to see. Thanks to John Fox, to Peter Godbold, continuing to recuperate. We're thinking of you, our brother. To Ben Birch, thank you. And always, 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 Gina, it's all for you.
Kincaid. 3 hours of conversation, cussing, and a discussing with America's only born and bred Southern liberal talk host. Head On with Bob Kincaid is brought to you each night by Coal River Mountain Watch. Coal River Mountain Watch invites you to become part of the solution, part of a sustainable future, part of the uprising against mountaintop removal. Coal River Mountain Watch, CRMW.net. And now, from high in the hills of beautiful West Pycod, Virginia, here's Bob Kincaid on the Head On Radio Network.
Well, howdy! A minute and 18 seconds past the hour as we begin this Tuesday evening, Tuesday late afternoon edition of Head On. I'm Bob, and it might be a Wednesday morning edition of Head On for all I know, depending on where you are. Greetings to the aliens from Planet Dwarf. It might be just a little bit past midnightmark for you today, and I hope it's a good midnightmark for you as we speak. Oh, let's see. We have several things to get done today. About 30 minutes from now, if everything works as planned, we will be having a conversation. We will be having a conversation with Dwayne Hunn about the American World Service Corps congressional proposals. He will be joining us via the phone. That's the way we do, of course, all of our guest conversations. Pretty neat technology. Why not just use the heck out of it? And we'll be talking about the American World Service Corps proposal and what he has in mind for it. Apparently, it would. I've had a couple of conversations with Dwayne, and it's a means of addressing pressing world and domestic needs, simply put. And God knows those needs need some addressing. Fascinating stuff in the email today. I've got an essay here that has been sent to me by a number of folks that fairly begs being read on the air. But you know how much I rather loathe the concept of reading on the air. You know, it's one thing to read a snippet here and there. It's another thing to sit and just, you know, lash you with an entire essay as if you didn't have the ability to go and find it for yourself. But once in a while, I find one interesting enough and compelling enough that it's worth doing on the air. I got one of those this evening, kindly provided by a number of listeners.
Kincaid. 3 hours of conversation, cussing, and a discussing with America's only born and bred Southern liberal talk host. Head On with Bob Kincaid is brought to you each night by Coal River Mountain Watch. Coal River Mountain Watch invites you to become part of the solution, part of a sustainable future, part of the uprising against mountaintop removal. Coal River Mountain Watch, CRMW.net. And now, from high in the hills of beautiful West Pycod, Virginia, here's Bob Kincaid on the Head On Radio Network.
Well, howdy! A minute and 18 seconds past the hour as we begin this Tuesday evening, Tuesday late afternoon edition of Head On. I'm Bob, and it might be a Wednesday morning edition of Head On for all I know, depending on where you are. Greetings to the aliens from Planet Dwarf. It might be just a little bit past mid-Mishlock for you today, and I hope it's a good mid-Mishlock for you as we speak. Oh, let's see. We have several things to get done today. About 30 minutes from now, if everything works as planned, we will be having a conversation. We will be having a conversation with Dwayne Hunt about the American World Service Corps congressional proposals. He will be joining us via the phone. That's the way we do, of course, all of our guest conversations. Pretty neat technology. Why not just use the heck out of it? And we'll be talking about the American World Service Corps proposal and what he has in mind for it. Apparently, it would. I've had a couple of conversations with Dwayne, and it's a means of addressing pressing world and domestic needs. Simply put, and God knows, those needs need some addressing. Fascinating stuff in the email today. I've got an essay here that has been sent to me by a number of folks that fairly begs being read on the air. But you know how much I rather loathe the concept of reading on the air. You know, it's one thing to read a snippet here and there. It's another thing to sit and just, you know, lash you with an entire essay as if you didn't have the ability to go and find it for yourself. But once in a while, I find one interesting enough and compelling enough that it's worth doing on the air. I got one of those this evening, kindly provided by a number of listeners who were apparently lit up and said, Bob, you got to read this on the air. Okay. So we may get to that. We've got a number of emails from last night. One starting things out, coming from Chris. He says, just sending an email to let you know how things are going and to give you my analysis on something. I've been thinking about the opinions that the Obama administration and Congress have been coming up with for the health care bill. So far, I've been hearing that there are plans to possibly make it mandatory for people to sign up for private insurance. This is the idea that Hillary Clinton proposed in her run as president, and that the plan that the Republicans are coming up with now. I see numerous problems with this. One, more money would go into the hands of insurance companies and give them more incentives to bankrupt working-class Americans. Two, how would the people that can't afford health care now be able to afford it if they are pushed by law to buy it? Finally, the main thing that nobody's talked about, to my knowledge, is that it would create another bubble economy. Working-class Americans would be buying insurance that they can't afford because it would be overpriced without honest regulations. This action would cripple the middle class, leading to bank loans, home foreclosures, etc. This possible option would only fix the problem with health care in the short term. But just like Wall Street in the dot-com era, there would be another meltdown in the economy. The only way to fix the system is to have single payer. But Obama has already taken that off the table. At least a public option would drive down cost and it would be in the best interest of America. But it seems that Obama has given up on the platform that he ran on. Hope. Thanks, Chris. I hadn't thought about the bubble aspect of it, but sure. If you don't contribute to the profit motive of the health insurers, is that somehow a violation of the law? And if it's a violation of the law, does it have a criminal penalty? I don't know. I'm not trying to scaremonger. I'm not into that. But it is certainly worth considering. I don't know what happens if they catch you not being insured. And then going back a couple of days, a confirmation of sorts from our buddy Michael, otherwise known as Kid A in the chat room, on Reverbo's proposal for a group field trip to the Creation Museum in Kentucky. Michael says, I'm loving it. I'm loving it. I'm just loving it. Reverbo's idea about a horn field trip to the Creation Museum. I've been saying for a few years now how fun it would be to go there and loudly point and laugh at everything and strike up loud conversations with random visitors, not challenging them, but on the premise that the museum is one big piece of comedy art and that anyone there saying otherwise is just hilarious and good on them, as they must be playing along in character. Michael is now firmly behind the idea of Cow Zero as a punk band name as well. God, I love the things you guys pick up on. It's beautiful. It's just beautiful. And moving on from there, also something coming in from our buddy Tosh about so-called defensive medicine that I didn't get to in last night's show that certainly that bears mentioning, because, you know, we had a conversation about the fact that that one of the side effects of the loopiness of tort reform, and this was in Friday's show, is that basically you let bad doctors get away with murder, or at least maiming. There's an old saying that they teach in law schools around the country that doctors are the only profession that is allowed to bury its mistakes. And that's true to this day. Mark Twain said it more succinctly. He said, despite the enlightened age in which we live, I yet remain convinced that when doctors and undertakers pass on the street, they quietly wink at one another. True, too. So, Tosh chimed in. And he said, I saw the positive side of medical torts like you described last December. At O'Dark 30, when I was being prepped for my shoulder surgery, they very, very carefully and persistently made double sure it was my right shoulder that would be operated on. That's the one I wanted worked on. To the point that while I was still awake and coherent, they marked my shoulder with a Sharpie in big letters, okay. That marking took several weeks to come off, and it ensured I only had my bad shoulder opened up. And referring to Matt Osborne's brilliant piece on tort reform at Huffington Post, Matt being a dear friend and occasional blogger for the Horn himself, Tosh says, what Matt Osborne appeared to be talking about was the awards made for medical insurance. There was another study that claimed that even the savings from defensive medicine are fairly small. And I would think that the savings from defensive medicine would be fairly small, and this is me editorializing, not Tosh writing, insofar as if you are competent at what you do, defensive medicine is not something that you're practicing. You are practicing the medicine that you were competently taught and competently trained and competently interned and residented to practice. It's those guys that are trying to cram in the one extra patient at the end of the day because, well, you know, one more patient a day and I can afford a 37-foot yacht instead of that dinky little 35-foot yacht, and I got to get the extra patient in and, oh, I cut off the wrong leg. But anyway, Tosh says, there are a couple of states that have instituted caps, and they found a composite savings of 3.4%, which is nice, but it's just a tenth of the estimated saving from eliminating the for-profit nature of primary health care. A tenth. Let's see, 10 times 3.4. Yeah, poor little math brain says that's 34%. Taking the profit motive out of primary health care would cut the cost of primary health care by 34%. Whoop! Anyway, Tosh continues, there's a reputable study that supports this statement, but I've forgotten the names. If you do the math, that means that of the $5,711 we spend per capita on health care, $194.17 goes to defensive medicine. If that is what it costs to make sure my doctor is right when it is my life, health, or misery that is at stake, I can handle that cost. So what I think Tosh is getting at is this. And you hear Republicans blathering on about this all the time. It's the defensive medicine that doctors have to practice that drives the cost of our health care up. You lie! you know, that kind of mush-mouth garbage that comes out of the rump of the old Confederacy on any given day. That defensive medicine, that's it. Yeah. If we could just take them trial lawyers out and shoot them real good, well, we wouldn't have these health care costs. And then, of course, you also wouldn't have George Bush running around as he did memorably. That woman that woman that had her wrong breast disease cut off and won a jury award, she has won life's lottery. Yeah. And in addition to all the emails that I did receive, Dennis Kucinich sent this around to his email list, and if you haven't read it yet, it deserves to be heard. There's not a link for it, so... It is said that one should not ask how sausage or laws are made. Are you concerned about a public option? Let me share with you some insight about health care legislation, which may not be good for your health. A lesson in politics, the Kucinich prediction, here's what's going to happen. And you know what? When you get a Kucinich prediction, write it down. Because the man has been proven to be right vastly more times than he has been proven wrong. In everything he said about the Iraq War, correct. In everything he said about Afghanistan, correct. In everything that he said about labor, correct. In everything he said about the shrinking middle class, correct. In everything that he said about health care, correct. In everything he said about Wall Street and banking, correct. So pay attention. A lesson in politics, the Kucinich prediction, here's what's going to happen. The House will make a big deal about putting a public option in H.R. 3200 because it competes with insurance companies and will keep insurance rates low. Two, the White House will refer to the president's speech last week where he spoke favorably of the public option. Three, the Senate will kill the competitive public option in favor of non-competitive co-ops. Senate leaders like Kent Conrad have said the votes to pass a public option were never there in the Senate. Four, the bill will come to a House-Senate conference committee without the public option. Five, House Democrats will be told to support the conference report on the legislation to support the president. Six, the bill will pass, not with a public option, but with a private mandate requiring 30 million uninsured to buy private health insurance if one doesn't already have it. If you're broke, you may get a subsidy. If you are not broke, you will get a fine if you do not purchase insurance. This legislative sausage will be celebrated as a new breakthrough and will be packaged as health insurance reform. However, the bill may require a Surgeon General's warning label, your money or your life. The bill that Congress passes may pale in comparison to the bill that millions of Americans will get every month, year, for having or not having private health insurance. It will take 4 years for the new legislation to go into effect. During that time, we are going to build a constituency of millions in support of real health care, a constituency which will be recognized and a cause which is right and just. Health care as a civil right. You know, is there any doubt why I have such profound admiration for this man? I hope not. Because, seriously, no crystal ball involved. That's exactly what's going to happen. Because some of it already has. And some of it is in the process of happening now. What did I tell you that I heard on the Sunday Babblehead shows? Will Barack Obama kill? Has he killed the public option?
No, but he's going to let the Senate do it for him.
God! So there's a screwin' coming. There is indeed a screwin' coming, and it's a screwin' for you. And a screwin' for me. and a screwing for America. And I got a couple of emails. One from David in Tennessee, and another from our pal Kate out on the desert, noting the passing of a woman whose name might not leap out there and just grab you until you get the fictionalized name. Yesterday the news came out that a woman by the name of Crystal Lee Sutton passed away. David in Tennessee said it matters a lot. I shall cry sometime. I'm after all a union man. She's gone, and despite good wishes and ponies from above for your birthday, the ethereal make no lasting gift. The worker always dies without. Always. They die without. Whether Ms. Sutton or Thomas Edward Roberts, known as Pig Champion to the music world, the worker always dies. Dies in need. Death trickles down. Not up. Crystal Lee Sutton's name may still not resonate with you, but Crystal Lee Sutton was a gutsy hero, and she deserves some serious remembering this evening, and this is what we're doing. You may not know Crystal Lee Sutton's name, but you know what Crystal Lee Sutton did, and you know the nerve and the steel and the force of her very being, because she was the real world person who was behind the fictionalized character as portrayed by Sally Field in a film called Norma Rae. She was 68 years old. She died of a brain tumor. She became involved in the union movement in North Carolina. When doing so was rather dangerous. The textile industry in North Carolina, having come to North Carolina based on the textile industry in New England's preference for not paying union wages to its workers. Well, we'll just move this thing down south, down there to the south where the workers are too stupid to ever form a union and are very authoritarianly based and will not dare stand up to us when we pay them pennies on the dollar for what they are worth.
Sounds good, boss. Sounds good.
Only Norma Rae, Crystal Lee Sutton, stood up and organized and organized and organized. And her life, such as it was made a living hell. But she, in the end of that struggle, was the winner and the hero of the piece. And as of yesterday, she transitioned off this planet. She passed away, not yesterday, but Friday, I should say, from brain cancer. gosh, in a place like North Carolina, where do you reckon something like brain cancer comes from? The more that I read about it, and the more that I consider what our human background is and our human history, the more I think that cancer, such as we, you know, it's a catch-all word, cancer, for all kinds of rotten things that the body can be made to do by outside influences. Cancer comes from outside. Something gets triggered. Yeah, there might be a genetic susceptibility, but something gets triggered, and something starts growing that ought not. The Associated Press reports, in 1973, Sutton was a mother of three earning $2.65 an hour folding towels at J.P. Stevens when a manager fired her for pro-union activity. In a final act of defiance before police hauled her out, Sutton, who had worked there 16 years, wrote union on a piece of cardboard and climbed onto a table on the plant floor. Employees responded by shutting down their machines. And in 1974, a union won the right to represent workers at seven plants in northeastern North Carolina. The movie was made about her, and she made very little money from the movie that was made off of her life. Now, that was the movie, was it not, where Sally Field leapt to the stage of the Academy Awards and declared, "You like me. You really, really like me." Perhaps never understanding the people who viewed that film, the ordinary working folks who shelled out of their pockets to buy a ticket to that film, watched it not in amazement that the former flying nun could actually act, but moved beyond almost expression at Crystal Lee Sutton's expression of her fundamental, basic, human, American, constitutional right to freedom of assembly and her unwillingness to be told no. The AP story does say, despite what many people think, Lee got little profit from the movie or an earlier book written about her. When they find out she lived very, very modestly, even poorly, in Burlington, North Carolina, they're surprised. Her son, Jay Jordan, said. Others, however, like David in Tennessee, were not surprised. The worker always dies in need, dies without. Death trickles down, not up. Now, in that rather standard fair obituary from the Associated Press, not much. But in the obituary that was published by McClatchy, this. She also advocated for women's rights, racial equality, help for the poor, and, after doctors found a malignant tumor on her brain, equal access to medical treatment. Anybody here surprised? Because the people who do it on the front line, on the ground, in the trenches, with corporate America in their faces, get a very, very, very quick understanding that, I'll go and stop being a union organizer, a labor rights organizer. I'll go and work on health care. But when you go and you work on health care, son of a bitch, if corporate America isn't right there in your face again, get away, quit it, shut up, sit down. He didn't smile. Okay, I'll quit being a health care rights advocate. I'll go work on gender equity. And there's corporate America again, in your face with the fangs dripping. She also advocated for women's rights, racial equality, help for the poor, and after doctors found a malignant tumor on her brain, equal access to medical treatment. Hello? Labor rights? Our environmental rights? Our our women's rights, our gender equity rights, our reproductive rights, our political rights, our health care rights. It's all the same. Because if you find yourself in any one particular movement and that movement leads you to be giving a damn about another human being, the next thing you know, you find yourself giving a damn about all the things that the world does to make humans' lives intolerable. And the next thing you know, you're not a labor rights activist anymore. You're not a health care rights activist anymore. You're not an environmental rights activist anymore. No, by God, you have graduated upward and you have become a human rights activist. Because these are all microcosmic portions of the overall struggle for basic human dignity for every last person on the planet. Kate also pointed out to me, she says, this article underscores my feeling that it's good to be talking about solutions rather than everyday political tripe in the media. I can worry and fuss about the silly racist factions in my society when I need to be concentrating on how to help folks cope with no potable water. And reminding me, chaotic systems are always self-correcting. With this link to this article, human-made crises outrunning our ability to deal with them, scientists warn. The world faces a compounding series of crises driven by human activity which existing governments and institutions are increasingly powerless to cope with, a group of eminent environmental scientists and economists has warned. Writing in the journal Science, the researchers say, energy, food, and water crises, climate disruption, declining fisheries, ocean acidification, emerging diseases, and increasing antibiotic resistance are examples of serious intertwined global-scale challenges spawned by the accelerating scale of human activity. The researchers come from Australia, Sweden, the United States, India, Greece, and the Netherlands. These issues are outpacing the development of institutions to deal with them and their many interactive effects. Stupid scientists. Don't they know that Jesus will protect the earth? You do know that right-wingers in this country have said that, and that's why, using that as their religious shield, they shill day in and day out to cover for the corporate killers and the corporate polluters in this country who don't care if they drive the planet off the edge of the cliff as long as they're getting theirs right now. Corporatism's, I think it may be safely said that corporatism in this country suffers from something that is can only be called attention deficit disorder on a corporate scale. Screw whether we can make any money 150 years from now. We're making money right now, baby, and lots of it. Blow that mountain up. Don't give a damn about who's here 150 years from now. I'm here right now. So, that's where the show begins this evening. And I hope you will find it to have begun on a good note. Oh, looky, my cell phone is ringing during the program, and dumbass Bob forgot to take his cell phone out of the studio. How about me? Oh, that's moderately frustrating. I've got to see about the interview that is upcoming, and hopefully get it squared away, so that we can have the conversation that we were planning on. Now, after the conversation, you know, of course, that your calls are more than welcome. 877-443-2366 is the number. 877, the numeral 4, head on, H-E-A-D-O-N. Email rolls into Bob Kincaid, B-O-B-K-I-N-C-A-I-D, @gmail.com. Chime in any way you want to. Chat room's open. Head on radionetwork.com/chatroom. It's free. Jump in. Enjoy yourself. We'll be right back after I see about getting our conversation going. This is America's listener-supported liberal voice. This is The Horn. You know, somehow or another, welcome back, by the way. Where'd you go? That was a great song. Why'd you leave? I love that XTC. Senses working overtime. Another one of those smart bands with sharp lyrics that just jump all over me. It is 23 minutes before the hour, and as promised, our conversation is forthcoming. Just to let you know who it is you're about to be hearing from, we have on the line with us Dwayne Hunn. And Dwayne Hunn is executive director of the People's Lobby. I will leave it to Dwayne to describe what it is, how the People's Lobby got started, and where it is that the People's Lobby is going. But the bottom line is that the People's Lobby is interested in pushing for the American World Service Corps. And that is an organization to be created by act of Congress, hopefully. And... well, just wait till Dwayne talks about it, okay? You're going to understand why this is exciting. Let's bring Dwayne on. Hey, Dwayne, are you with us?
Yes, I am, Bob. Can you hear me okay?
I hear you just fine. Thank you so much for joining us, and thank you for the sharing this information with the folks who share their time with the Horn.
Thank you.
Where do you want to start?
Well, maybe I had to just... tell your listeners a little bit about People's Lobby, and then I'd like to get into some of the stuff you were just talking about for the last 10 or 15 minutes. People's Lobby was founded in the late 60s by Ed and Joyce Kupel, two giants of people. Ed had never been involved in politics, but he got ticked off because some oil companies were raking off on this very expensive housing development that he was living in. They made some of the people pay for their properties, stuff like that. So he got so involved in the politics, and he was the kind of guy that didn't like to complain about issues. He wanted to do something. He looked around for a tool. He was a very handy guy, and the tool he found was the Initiative Referendum and Recall, which Hiram Johnson out here in the mid-1860s initiated into the California Constitution. Unfortunately, West Virginia, where you've done a lot of good work, doesn't have the initiative process, but 24 or 27, depending on how you count them, states do. And with that initiative process, Ed got involved. First, it was one of the first things was a recall of Reagan, and he probably got the signatures, but they jimmied the signature count back there. And then we did two clean environment initiatives to lower the lead content of gasoline, cut sulfide oxide emissions from diesel fuel, put a stunt on the construction of nuclear power plants until they can go through a routine that proved they were safe, and ban the use of DDT in the state of California. Those two campaigns brought all the biggies out against us, the motor companies, the oil companies, the nuclear industry, and we lost those two campaigns, and most of us were youngsters at that point, and we were a little dejected, and our rebuttal to him when we had a steering board of 30 or 40 people who actually worked at this for free, basically. And Ed said, well, you know, you did a good fight. What are you upset about? And we said, we'll never win. We can't beat the big money. And he says, well, if you don't like the money, then do something about it. So we wrote the second political reform act that passed in the state government in the history of the United States. And we ticked off both the Republicans and the Democrats because we were basically taking the milk from them. All the money, we limited what lobbyists could give to a Big Mac, a shake, and a fries. And some of our stringent conditions were then eased on some by the state Supreme Court. But we established the Fair Political Practices Commission, which started throwing politicians in jail for cheating. So that was one of our big steps. And to jump ahead from all that, Ed unfortunately passed away, and his wife did recently too. And we got involved with a Senator Mike Gravel, who we had put on hearings back in Washington, D.C. to establish a national initiative process. So you can have a process whereby if, say, you wanted to get out of Vietnam, and during that period, you could write a law to cut the funding of the Defense Department or get you out of Vietnam. We had 3 days of hearings, and he was part of those hearings, so he was enamored with the idea. He's trying to run with that idea, and he, in the process, he owes us a bunch of money, which he's not paying back. But From that, I also said I ran the campaign out in Maine for 3 months where we tried to get the national initiative process going, an updated version of it. And what happened was I started saying to myself, you know, the real problem in this country is that Americans aren't involved enough. And you addressed that point earlier, and again, I'll get back to that, but I'll finish this history. People's Lobby, then I said to myself, since I'm running People's Lobby and I'd like to get Americans involved, and I think there's a tremendous dumbing down of America that's been going on for a long time, what's the best way to get Americans smartened up? And, you know, when a person is told you're going to write a book, write about something you know. Well, I had served in the Peace Corps. I'd worked with People's Lobby. I'd done Habitat projects. And I always thought that those were more important than the degrees I received. And that was the best way for me to learn. And I was certain that if more Americans were exposed to what you see as a Peace Corps volunteer in the slums of Bombay and what you see as a habitat builder in Georgia or Sri Lanka or anywhere in the world, that really gives you an understanding of the world and gets you involved in the world. So when you come back, you make political decisions that are much smarter and much more attuned to what's needed. So the legislation, consequently, that the first piece of legislation we wrote is called, as you said, the American World Service Corps Congressional Proposals. And here's what it does. If it were passed, say, this year in Congress, it would take 7 years to ramp up. It would ramp up by about 160,000 Americans per year until by the seventh year you had 1 million additional Americans voluntarily serving in their choice of such organizations, and you could add to this list, such organizations as Peace Corps, AmeriCorps, Habitat, Doctors Without Borders, Head Start, Red Cross, International Rescue Committee, Oxfam, Mercy Corps, and State Conservation Corps. And again, as I said, you could add smaller local groups to that list that wanted volunteers to help them full-time for a year or two. Now, we figure 65 to 70% of those people would be young people now. And but we also want those baby boomers and retirees to come in, because if you're going to put 1 million Americans, once it gets to the seventh year, there's 1 million Americans voluntarily serving, and our proposal says you cannot sunset this legislation for 20 years. So in 27 years, or literally a generation, you will have plugged in 21 million Americans dealing with problems at home or abroad, and they will not only address the problems and come up with creative solutions, but they'll be so involved in the world that their political policy IQ will go through, well, compared to what it is now, it'll go through the roof. And you consequently will be forcing more politicians to be smarter, and also hopefully, because one of the things that also bothered a bunch of us, it seems like politicians are always running for dog catcher, supervisor, this, that, all the way up the ladder, and their whole career is built on being a politician. And, you know, in this day and age, that usually means taking a bunch of money from people who are going to pad you up the ladder. We would rather see people say, I'm going to vote for this guy because this guy was a Peace Corps volunteer. I'm going to vote for this woman because she was an assistant to Doctors Without Borders, not that she was in a political system for a long time. So if the law were passed as we've written it, and this went on for a generation, we think many of the problems that you were alluding to in your 10-minute lead in 10, 15 minutes there would be addressed. And I've talked an awful lot, so I'll...
Yeah, but you did it. You did it beautifully. Because I was sitting here, Dwayne, while thinking of questions, and the next thing I know, the answer to the question comes out, and that tells me that you have anticipated objections and anticipated questions based on a desire to see things like this actually succeed. You mentioned the initiative process in 27 states. Let me ask you this, based on your experience with it, precursor question. The project, as you envision it, is for congressional action and therefore to be done on a national basis. What is it that sets it apart from something like VISTA or the Peace Corps? And secondly, is this something that, barring congressional action, you would like to see done on a state-by-state basis with that initiative process?
Yes. Well, okay. The first point, no, it isn't different than VISTA or AmeriCorps or Peace Corps. What it does, however, is, you know, we've just passed the Serve America Act. Kennedy, basically, they passed it, you know, in honor of Kennedy. And what it does, and I should jump back a little bit, we approached all the presidential candidates asking them to do this. We've been working on this for 4 years. It's going too slowly. I mean, this is such a common sense, simple thing to do. But everybody is hesitant, and most of the politicians are, quote, politicians. They're leery on doing something big, bold, and visionary. So this is not an initiative. We've stepped outside of People's Lobby's traditional role because we're asking Congress to implement it because there is no mechanism to do it on a national level, to make this law with people pushing it, except through Congress. Well, what's very different in this law, since Obama was given a package of this during his campaign, and within a week I had a letter back saying it's these kind of ideas that inspire me on the campaign trail. And then a month or so after that, his staff called and talked for a half an hour. Now, if you look at the Serve America bill in the national service program that Obama has been talking about, you know, maybe it's just coincidence, and a lot of people have these ideas, you know, but we've had it in legislation for 5 years, I guess. He's integrated a lot of what we're saying. He's called it something different, like Green Corps, Teacher Corps, and other corps. And with the bill that Kennedy passed, what they're trying to do is bolster the size of the Peace Corps, but unfortunately, they're taking it back to the size it was in 1969. There were 15,000 Peace Corps volunteers serving in the world. Now, Kennedy started it in 61, and he wanted it to quickly grow to 100,000 because, as he said to Harris Warford, one of the deputy directors of the Peace Corps at that time, he said, you know, when it hits a million, it'll be significant. It'll have an impact in the world. Well, then you had all of our emphasis on wars and Nixon not liking the Peace Corps and not liking BA generalists to go out in the world and come back with an assessment of the world.
They'll come home communists, Henry. They'll come home communists.
Right, right. You know, I my parish priest, who was one of the guys that got probably helped get me in my high school, accused me of being a communist when I came back saying, hey, you know, where are the priests over there with all these people in need? Both when we worked in South Bronx in poverty and when you work overseas and watch people dying on the streets, you know, you say to yourself, God, you know, the world is really in need. So this Serve America bill is nice, but it only doubles the size of the Peace Corps. If this bill were passed on top of it, which we're trying to get people like Joe Sestak involved, you know, if you put this down there, you would not only win votes, but you would get, you know, maybe 50, 100,000 in the Peace Corps. Maybe there'd be 10,000 more full-time habitat workers, and you'd take care of rural poverty in America, housing needs, and overseas. So we want to boost those up to a level where, since we are on an economic precipice, and Roosevelt, Franklin, had 3 million people doing WPA and CCC back then, we're saying, why don't you have a million a year doing this? And in return, getting the simple paybacks. I probably didn't mention the paybacks in the bill, but we'll probably get to it. So did that answer some of your questions?
Yes, absolutely. Obviously, you're talking to someone who thinks that this would be a marvelous idea and a magnificent use of American energies. And probably, it is impossible to overestimate the goodwill that's been generated through the Peace Corps. Is that a fair statement?
I think that's a very fair statement, yeah. You know, it's, you know, like Greg Mortensen, Three Cups of Tea, you're familiar with the book?
Yes, yes.
You know, Greg Mortensen is basically being a Peace Corps volunteer. And that's what Iraq and Afghanistan needs. I sometimes go back. Afghanistan and Pakistan, they haven't had a Peace Corps volunteer. 67, I think, was the last year they had a Peace Corps volunteer in Pakistan. They might have had a few in 1991, and then it disappeared again. Afghanistan hasn't had a Peace Corps volunteer since the 70s, 71 or around there. And you look at that, in 48 or 49 years of the Peace Corps, in those two countries, you've had less than 2,200 Peace Corps volunteers. But every one of those Peace Corps volunteers probably imprinted on some Afghani something that might save a soldier's life today. because they remember Americans as decent as good. We don't do enough of that, and that's another ulterior motive behind this thing, is we're trying to get people, you know, to, you have a lot of Congress people who talk about peace, and you have a bunch of groups that are trying to, like, build a Department of Peace, which I think is fine. I think it's wonderful to talk about peace. I think it would be great to have a Department of Peace. But if I were in charge and I had X number of dollars and X amount of time to devote to something, rather than building a Department of Peace from the top down, I would say, let's get a million Americans in the field, at home and abroad, taking care of our problems and the world's problems. That would, to me, be much more important. And it's much more important than a politician talking about it. You're getting Americans involved. You know, recently, Time magazine just did their third story, and I've tried to get through to that Stengel guy. I've tried to present this to some heavy hitters, but they find some reason not to invite people's lobby and let me come and talk about it. I don't get it, but they just ran another piece in this week's Time magazine where they're calling about the responsibility revolution. That's one of the things they're calling for. And they want more Americans to be responsible and volunteer. And he interviews Obama and the Obamas together. And Obama says everything that gels with this, you know. The guy Stengel, the editor for Time magazine, says, you'd like this to be bigger. And they say yes, but Mrs. Obama says, except it's very expensive, and we don't know how to do it. Well, we thought of that, too, and it meshes with this responsibility revolution, the term Time seems to be wanting to coin. So I'd say, fine, you want responsibility? Not only is it responsible for Americans to buy hybrids and to be careful about wasting paper and take cloth bags to the store and to do little good things in their neighborhood, that's fine. But on a bigger level, get them involved full-time for a year or two. That really notches it up. But in addition to that, the responsibility for the rich in this country is part of the way we pay for this in the legislation. We have seven traditional funding mechanisms in the bill, some, you know, that you're all familiar with, like an import duty on those developed nations with which we run a significant trade deficit, and a bunch of other little traditional funding mechanisms. And we make a way to make it all work, partly because it's cheap. You know, it's like 7 to 10 times cheaper to send one of these American World Service Corps volunteers into the world than to send a soldier. And when you consider the at-end cost, the PTSD and the injuries and all that, it's a hell of a lot cheaper to do this, and it makes it cheaper on our soldiers because they're not shot at. But the non-traditional funding mechanisms we have in the bill really go to the heart of what's happening in America when you say the middle class is shrinking and disappearing. And I imagine, you know, we're seeing a lot in California, but I haven't been in Appalachia for years now. But
yeah, what middle class?
Yeah, you know, it's even tougher there. And so, but what's happened at the top is, you know, you just read some of those David K. Johnson books, and the rich are getting extremely rich. And last year there were 550, they estimated, billionaires before the crash in America, and they're still going to do all right. They're going to buy up everything. What we've done is say, all right, look, this is not mandatory in our bill, but it's very out of the box for politicians to accept, and maybe that's part of the reason they don't let us talk about it in front of big groups, heavy hitters. But we've said, hey, you list the Forbes 400 richest Americans, and you use that Commie Pinko magazine, Forbes magazine, source, and you list what those people have given as charitable contributions. And, of course, you got Gates and Buffett and Soros and Turner that are given 20 to 40 years and more, like he's given 60% of his wealth away. Those guys give their wealth away and are giving their wealth away. But almost all the rest, it's stunning when you see this for the first time, are like 0 to 5% of their wealth are in charitable contributions. So we say, you know, we just want, if you get the World Service Corps going, you have a website, it's called the American World Service Corps website, and you list the Forbes 400 or 550 richest American billionaires, and you have one column, and it says, what will you voluntarily give to underwrite the cost of sending Americans to do good at home or abroad, which is good for business, I mean, unless you're a defense contractor. And, you know, we think that Oprah would probably give, and, you know, some of these guys who already give would say, well, that's a good thing, and I'll go do that. And Gates would maybe say, you know, not only do we need computers overseas and dealing with eradicating...
We need clean electricity to run them.
Yeah, and we need people to go and help do these things, and it would be great if Americans did it. So we think if it were publicized enough, you could underwrite the cost and reduce the taxpayer cost of running this organization. But you know what percent of their wealth they would have to annually give to totally underwrite the cost of this for 27 years? Want to take a guess? Are you in a guessing mood?
1.2%.
You're really good. 1.7%. We call it the 2%, the Forbes 2% solution. And that's just Forbes. What we also propose was like putting athletes. You know, these athletes that get 5, 10, whatever million dollars per year for throwing a ball. And I love throwing a ball, but, you know, hell, is it really worth it? You list those people. You list the entertainer types that make a whole bunch of money and say, hey, you know, don't just be a fundamental Christian. What are you going to give to spend to send what Christ would do out into the world? And we think you could underwrite this by having this responsibility revolution that Time magazine is starting to push. There's a responsible revolution for the rich to get involved and say, God, we've been making it so much over the last 20 or 30 years that maybe we ought to give something back.
You know, there are so many, my mind is going in 16 different directions at once, Duane. You know, based on what we do here in Appalachia and the issue that is, for, you know, the mission statement for the organization I work with, Coal River Mountain Watch, the mission statement says, end mountaintop removal and rebuild sustainable communities. This kind of thing occupies, you would be, well, maybe not surprised, but a stunning amount of my time. Just trying to, it's like contemplating some sort of Zen koan. What does that mean, rebuild sustainable communities? What does it mean inside Appalachia? What does it mean outside in the world as well? Because, of course, in the recent past, you had the departure of Van Jones from the Council on Environmental Quality in the Obama administration. That was a sad and shameful moment. But part of what he has preached on so much has been this green jobs revolution, you know, the green collar economy, the color of change, the green for all, taking these concepts of a way of living a little bit more lightly on the planet and making that concept make all of, you know, not just the rich, not just the poor, not just the middle class, but all of our lives more meaningful and more real, if you will.
Yeah.
And if you take a concept like that and you tie it in with what you're talking here about here with the American World Service Corps, then it's hard for me to see how that doesn't wind up being a net win wherever it happens, whether it's an organization working inside the United States to go forth and help people, you know, cut their energy bills, thereby reducing the amount of carbon going into the world and cutting down on the poisoning of individual communities. I don't know if you saw the water article in the New York Times this past weekend, but it was one of those things where you just sit there with your eyes bugged out and your mouth open in that sort of Norwegian silent scream painting look on your face. All of that, but expanding that around the world, too. I'm sitting here looking at a story, Duane. When I saw it yesterday, I kept it in the stack for today because it was another silent scream moment. Flower giveaway in Pakistan turns into deadly stampede. 14 women, and of course, if you think back to John Lennon's famous song title, which I will not repeat on the air, about woman is of the world. Maybe that makes me too precious, but I just hate that word, and I won't use it. Woman is. And 14 women were stomped to death trying to get some flour in Pakistan. And the saddest part of this is that it was an altruistic moment by a man named Chaudhry Iftikhar. And at his own expense, in his compound, he gave away the flour. And this guy's been arrested now because he didn't notify the proper authorities. Because anytime you give away food in Pakistan, there's every chance in the world that there's going to be a life-threatening riot of people simply trying to get to the flour.
Yeah.
You know, this stuff doesn't have to happen. And the United States taking a leadership role, not that I want to meddle in anybody's internal affairs, but I don't think the government of Pakistan wants 14 women stomped to death over a 5-pound bag of flour.
Yeah.
Yeah, we can take a leadership role in this stuff. I'm sorry, you got me a little bit worked up. Am I way off the farm now?
No, I don't think so. No, in fact, another deeper reason behind, there are a bunch of reasons behind doing the World Service Corps, and you alluded to it in just your comments just now. We're saying, hey, you know, if America got this up and going, if the world knew that America, where we're pretty much despised now, in the late 60s we were ugly Americans, now we're just jokes. You know, people make America jokes now and despised. So if this were up and going, the world would say America's really sending a million of their people to do good at home and abroad, then we're saying maybe you'll shift the competition, which we're going to start losing at in every field, from who's got the biggest army, China, and who's America think we're going to have a threat with, China, and then Russia's not very happy with us trying to get rid of the dollar as the economic bearer, as the economic standard. If we did this, maybe China would say, oh, hey, they're sending people to do good in the world. Ah, maybe we need to build an army of 1 million. And Russia says, oh, they're sending good to, oh, they're going to win hearts and minds. We better send people to do that's kind of good. The kind of good I think that might have been the vision in Kennedy's head when he said, I want it to grow to 1 million. Because he, I think, looked further ahead than most presidents do. I was watching 13 Days the other night. And, you know, you remember how this guy had some vision about things that would happen in the future. He didn't want to listen to Curtis LeMay, and he got in trouble with the Joint Chiefs and all that stuff. But can you imagine if we got this thing going and you shifted the focus from who's got the biggest military and the best drones to who can do the most good in the world? Because we can't afford to keep competing on a military basis, sending out weapons of mass destruction, having some lost in the black market, and blowing up people and throwing them in Guantanamo when there are maybe 10,000 terrorists in 2001, and now you have maybe 10 million in the world. So this changes the team making, and it's like moving from barbarism where you're clubbing people to death to play, and being moving from the stadiums where you have the lions eat the gladiators to playing football and having referees and doing something that makes people enjoyable. But this is even much better than that because you're actually out working with the people. You told a story earlier on your show about Israel and Palestine and these ads they were running and how you thought it was despicable, how they're degrading the relations between humans. Well, you've never had a Peace Corps volunteer in Palestine. You've never had one in Israel. And how much do Americans understand about going on in those places? But if you were sending the World Service Corps workers to work there and say, look, we're going to work in a school that Palestinians and Israelis go to, and we're going to build a school on the border, and you're going to go to school together, we're going to run camps together, that would do so much for the world, but we don't have a mechanism. We don't have an army that's big enough to do that, and this gives you that army.
Are there provisions, for instance, you talked about the BA generalists coming out of college and going and, you know, when you were talking about the Peace Corps. Are there debt forgiveness provisions inside this? Because
I didn't get to the, yes.
And the reason I ask is one of the most insidious parts of the college education process is that, and don't think for a minute that I don't think that the lenders who under the Bush administration were given, you know, the fundamental basic decency of college loans at low interest were turned into, once again, a freaking profit vehicle for predatory lenders. Don't think I don't know that they don't understand what the gig is, because you take these bright, talented people who are coming out of colleges with, you know, great liberal arts degrees, things that really, really, to me, matter in the world. And I'm not denigrating anybody's, you know, specific degree in accounting or anything like that. No, not what I'm doing. But they immediately have to go and find some job, preferably in corporate America, because that's the highest paying stuff, in order to service the daggum debt. And thereby, that good that those recent graduates might have gone into the world and done trivialized.
Yeah, they don't do it. They can't do it. They got to go back into the corporatocracy and get the kind of education that some of the people who ran the last administration had, all corporate experience.
Right. And so if you create a mechanism, and you're telling me it's there, and I hope you'll tell me about it, if you create a mechanism whereby people are able to get debt forgiveness, the Christian concept of jubilee, get debt forgiveness out of this and get all of this experience and then bring it home to their own communities, how's that not a great idea?
Yep. And actually, they've integrated what we had in the bill. Went something like this. It said, while you're in service, if you had college debt, they're frozen. And each year you serve, it's dropped. I forget how much we dropped the percentage by, the loan percentage interest rate by such and such amount. And you're given another 2 years after, if you do 2 years, another 2 years before you have to start paying. But in addition, what you get while you're, if you do 2 years of service, here's what you get. You get $600, $250 per month served. So if you do 2 years, about $6,000. That's just asking in your pocket. Your living expenses are covered while you're in, but you don't get you're not living high off the hog. In addition to that, you get your choice of 2 years of community college tuition plus 2 years of state college tuition, or that cash equivalent can be used as a home down payment, or that cash equivalent can be put into your medical savings or IRA account. And our backup bill says, once you get to that 1 million level, we want it to stay within 5% of a million, because we don't want an administration that comes in and says, oh, this is dangerous, and this is, we're too many Americans are understanding the world, so we're going to drop it down to 100,000 per year. So our bill, our backup bill, says it has to stay within 5% of 1 million for the next 20 years, so you really get 21 million over 27 years doing this kind of service. Or you have to increase the incentives in the bill. One of those might be like total forgiveness of whatever kind of debt you had if you're only getting, say, 800,000 that are working 1 year. So you have to increase the incentives so that that number comes back up and we have this big army going out and doing this stuff. We kept what we're paying, or rewarding volunteers at a pretty, I think, basic level, because at the time that we drafted the bill, you had the war going on in Iraq, and those guys didn't even have, college education being covered. You had to fight for it again. So we wanted to make sure that soldiers who put their life on the line, of course, get more remuneration on doing service. But these American World Service Corps volunteers should get something like that, too, so they also serve. And what has been interesting, I work with a lot of vets, because I work with Nadia McCafferty on Veterans Villages, and her son was murdered. Her son was a National Guard member who only joined with the stipulation that he stay near his family. He wanted to serve his country after 9/11, and they promised him he would. He probably guard a nuclear power plant because he had two kids and a wife, and as it turned out, 6 months later, he was in Iraq at Fort Balad, and then he was, as President Bush was constantly saying back then, we're going to train them up so we can stand down. He was training the Iraqi soldiers. He wasn't trained to do this, but he was the leader of the enlisted men, the strongest guy in the group, the toughest guy, the smartest guy, the most sensitive guy, and he was murdered by the very Iraqi troops that he was training up. Because they shot him from behind when his lieutenant and he came under sniper fire. And so I work a lot with these guys, and they all appreciate this. And what was interesting is a couple guys from the military who served in Iraq came back. Two of them went and did the Peace Corps after doing Iraq. And, the one, when he told the story, the first time I met this young man was at Nadia's home, and it turned out that he said he'd be in a firefight in Iraq, and he'd be picking up the dirt, and he'd say, God, this stuff wife is really rich, and he said we'd be in a firefight, and over there in the corner would be a farmer. He just keep plowing his field, you know, with his mule. And he says, even though we're in a firefight, he just kept doing his thing. And he had some sort of connection to the earth. So when he came out, he joined the Peace Corps, went to Nigeria to become not a wheat farmer, but whatever, I forget what it was he was growing. But he says, I knew less about this stuff than they did. You know, when they looked at me, the first white guy they've seen come in their village, and a guy who doesn't know a hell of a lot about farming, he says he's there for a year, and he got his re-up notice. And he says, what do you mean re-up? He says, I did my 4 years. And, of course, there's that fine print in the military contract that says...
No, you didn't.
You know, for 4 years or to the duration of the conflict. And that's what they said. No, the conflict's not over. So I said to him, I said, well, did the Peace Corps director fight on your behalf? And he said, no. He said, go. Huh. But luckily, Michael O'Gorman from Farms Not Arms went to bat for him, and they got him discharged. But he and his buddy... did the Peace Corps, and he once said, he defined it this way, he said, you know, in Iraq, I know I did bad things, and I don't want to do them again. He said, in the Peace Corps, he said, I don't know if I did a hell of a lot of good, but I know I did nothing bad.
Yeah, it's almost like the first line of the Hippocratic Oath, isn't it? First, do no harm.
Yeah.
Because that's the stepping stone from to doing good. First thing you got to make sure is you're not hurting anybody. And God, this has so many real world implications. Let's talk about the unreal world, Dwayne. Namely, Congress. You know, they don't live in anything you and I would recognize as reality. What is going on with your efforts in Congress?
Well, you know, I guess to be gentle on Congress, I'd say there's been a lot of crap hit the fan recently. For years, I've had conversations with somebody very high up in Senator Feinstein's staff. Very good conversations. Senator Feinstein is one of my two senators, her and Boxer in the state of California, and she kept saying, "Well, Dwayne, shouldn't we do this smaller?" And I kept saying what I've been saying to you, but I'd say things like, "You know, how bad does the world have to get before we do something big?" And I said, we got big problems in the world, and we don't have the right army to counteract global climate change, poverty, hatred, and a dumbed-down political IQ. So, but they were always good, constructive conversations. And then with my congresswoman, even though she hand-wrote a note and said, I love the idea, she didn't really understand it for a long time. And I had kind of given up on her, but I went back 2 years ago to D.C. and met with 22 staffs, and all of the staff except maybe Ron Paul's staff, and Ron Paul's was on the phone if I remember, but 22 in person back there, and they all seemed to be open to it, but again, they were starting to get to be very busy. And also, I met with Boxer's staff back here. They want me to go back to D.C. and talk to her staff again, because Boxer introduced legislation for People's Lobby before, back in 1989, wrote up a bill that was called the Soviet American Peace Corps, but they changed it to American Soviet Peace Corps. We always have to go first. I was trying to make the Soviets feel good. And what it basically would be is if you were a Soviet and I were an American, the Soviets would have a Peace Corps and America would have a Peace Corps. We'd train together and then we'd go to a village and we'd serve together. And I said, if you did that for 2 years, and you did that 15,000 times with, you know, 30,000 Americans and Soviets, you wouldn't have any problems with nuclear weapons raining down on each other. And she introduced that legislation. So Boxer, I'm hopeful, still hopeful, since her staff likes it, that I'll be able to get back and try to get them geared up on that again. With my congresswoman, I kind of gave up and had one last meeting where I said, you know, hey, look, can you just have your staff call, you know, 15 people that I'd already met with some of them. I said, I just want them to be warmed up again, then I'll pick it up and keep trying to get them to do it this session. And she said her staff was too busy, and then I said, well, would you just call one? And that's the person I really would like to sponsor this. If you have any listeners that are connected in Pennsylvania, I wish they would push Joe Sestak. I've had good conversations with his legislative director. And Joe Sestak, as a rear admiral, you know, who's articulate and bright, and now he's, you know, running, I guess, against Arlen Specter for Senate, maybe. I'd like him to be one of the introductors. And my congresswoman at that time then said, oh, I love Joe Sestak, but I don't think he'd co-sponsor anything with me, because she's kind of very liberal, and Joe Sestak's somewhere in the middle, and that's part of the reason I wanted Joe Sestak. And then she said she'll introduce it. So for a period there, it was going to be introduced, and I said, well, that would be great if you introduced it and if Joe Sestak were the co-sponsor, because then it would roll better. So those in Congress have been some of my contacts, and a great contact was when I went back and met with Jim Webb's office, because we spent 90 minutes together, and it wasn't, you know, sometimes you meet with people down the ladder, in the middle of the ladder, and the directors, and those can be good meetings because you're meeting with somebody high up. But this case, it was a guy who had been in the Marine Corps with him, gone to law school with him, was his chief counsel, and they seemed very interested in making it happen. But as you know, Webb got very involved in getting the veterans stuff done, and then the economy went south. And the economy going south kind of hurt our efforts here, too. We're trying to straighten that out so we can plug back in. But, you know, if your listeners are at all active, I would hope that, one, they would go to the website and sign the petition. The website is just www.worldservicecorps.us, and People's Lobby's website is www.peopleslobby.us. But more than that, you know, if they want to take the next step, and again, I don't know how, I wish they would write to their senators and congressmen and mention People's Lobby's American World Service Corps, and if they do, you know, drop an email to us and let us know that. And then beyond that, if anybody gets excited and wants to try and spread it in their community, we'd like to have speakers. We have PowerPoint presentations at the website that if you're a teacher and you want to use it in the classroom, I've used it in high school classrooms and college classrooms. It's pretty effective. It's already there. You just download it and use it. But those kind of things, in our coverage link, there's a bunch of writings that you can forward to people. So if anybody felt like helping in that sense, it would be helpful, because, as you know, these grassroots movements, especially in a time of a poor economy, are, you know how they are.
Well, yeah, and one last thing, and I'm not trying to be overtly negative, but are you inured to the fact that we are in a time right now, Duane, where you're going to have to deal with a certain segment of the population that's going to scream, oh, hell no, communism?
Oh, yeah. Well, ironically, now, I'm in a pretty liberal community, you know, progressive, whatever you want to call it, and I've tried very hard to get in front of the Republicans, and it's very difficult, but I have some that come to these mixed Rotary Club meetings, things like that, you know, and it's very difficult for them to attack this. In fact, I've had some very